Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Monday, May 8th, 2017. And coming up in this podcast, I'm going to cover what I think is the most serious poison pill in the Trump healthcare reform. And I'll just give you a tip. If you get your insurance through your employer right now, that's at risk. But for me, in my little universe, the most important story today is in the Guardian newspaper from Britain. It was published, I believe, yesterday. And I want to thank Andy Worthington, the London-based journalist who's done exhaustive coverage of Guantanamo, for tipping me off on Facebook to this important story. And what it shows is that Steve Bannon was not just a guy from Breitbart, a propagandist, the alt-right voice who was recruited to help Trump with messaging. No, his critical role in the campaign, which has up till now been obscured, is that he helped manage a huge data operation. It was funded by Robert Mercer, the hedge fund billionaire. They collected data on people, and they used social media data to inform them as to who could be persuaded with information that was racist or anti-immigrant or otherwise nationalist in tone, and where the persuadable people might be. And I've linked to this story. It runs, 10 or 15 pages. And it's really well written. It is well sourced. There are a couple of unnamed people in it. But it really helps bring together the operations that were used to sell Trump to the American people and to manipulate some people into voting for him. Now, you may have heard of the firm Cambridge Analytica. This is the operation owned by Mercer and where Steve Bannon was a top executive. And in all of the profiles of Bannon that we've heard about, he was a Goldman Sachs guy and he invested in the Seinfeld reruns and that's how he made his fortune. And then when Andrew Breitbart died, he was the number two guy at Breitbart. And everything's been built around that narrow frame of his role in the Breitbart I don't really want to call it media, but it's movement media for the far right. And this story also ties in Eric Schmidt, who has been the CEO of Google. He's still on the board there. And it appears that his daughter helped introduce the original firm, a British operation, that was purchased by Cambridge Analytica, to use data to wage campaigns starting in African nations where the, shall we say, legal standards were extremely low. So this provides, I think, a very interesting window into the Trump propaganda operations and, for example, linkage to the Brexit movement, because the British company I just referenced that was purchased by Cambridge Analytica is called Aggregate IQ. And Aggregate IQ is actually based in Victoria, British Columbia. But they had heavy participation in the Leave side of the Brexit campaigns. Almost half of the money spent by the central Vote Leave campaign was spent through Aggregate IQ. Now, I know a little bit about this stuff because I work as a media consultant occasionally on campaigns. I've actually dialed it back because I'm pretty frustrated and turned off by the campaign game in this country. But if you work on an election campaign, there are Democratic and Republican data companies that can help you identify who your voters are. And they use data from the Board of Elections. They merge it together with the stuff they can get from a credit report, from other public sources. They get your information from Facebook. And that apparently was a critical piece of the manipulation operation that was run by Cambridge Analytica. And so there's a great deal more in this story. I highly encourage you to read it through the link that I've provided. And one of the bottom lines here is the issue that I've been uncomfortable with Facebook about since I started using it, 8 or 9 years ago. And that is that we are self-reporting. The information that we post, whether it's about where we had lunch and with whom. And by the way, I had a great lunch with Matt Renner, my former producer today. Happy birthday, Matt. But all kinds of information, like your political attitudes, whether you leaned Bernie or Hillary last year, whether you have visited websites where you might find alt-right information. The article shows that if you do a certain Google query, like, was the Holocaust real? It will lead you to dark websites that you would never find through an ordinary Google search. And as you know, through the coverage I've done with Yasha Levine, who is still working on his book Surveillance Valley, Google is a is a company that has collected massive amounts of data on us. They use it, they tell us, just to serve ads to us. But their political alliances have been highly fungible. And the article also brings into play the company Palantir, a Silicon Valley firm with government contracts, NSA and others. It's run by Peter Thiel, the gay billionaire who spoke up for Trump at the convention last summer and is a a guy with very flexible ethics, to put it kindly. And so this ties together the money of Mercer, the influence of Steve Bannon sitting atop a mountain of data that can be used in a rather cynical and subversive way. And then you connect it to Brexit. Nigel Farage, a friend of Bannon's. And the linkage now is Cambridge Analytica. So is there a smoking gun here? No. And I have been one to expose the disinformation efforts that were run for the Hillary Clinton campaign by David Brock through his dark money super PAC called Correct the Record. So I'm equal opportunity here. I'll expose anybody who tried to manipulate voters during this campaign, but it looks like both campaigns worked very hard at it. The Trump campaign had this secret system of Cambridge Analytica. And this still begs a lot of questions about those Ruskies. We'll get to that in a moment. But first, the big news that I think was a relief to many people was that the insurgent campaign of far-right nationalist Marine Le Pen in France came up way short. She got well under 40% of the vote. And Emmanuel Macron, who is a guy who never held office. He's 39 years old. He started this party, a splinter party, about a year ago. So the establishment did not win in France. They were able to repel the greater threat from Marine Le Pen. But this guy, Macron, is a wild card. He is a guy who has made money as an investment banker. And a lot of people love the sidebar story that he is married to his high school drama coach, and she's 24 years older than he is. And the only relevant comparison is that the current president of the United States is married to a woman who is exactly 24 years his junior. So it was primarily a negative vote. And what's fascinating is that on Friday, there was the report of a massive hacking attack on the Macron campaign. And oh, did Rachel Maddow eat it up. And in the next day's edition, the New York Times was in sync more with Maddow, saying, look, this is so similar to what happened in the United States. And in particular with Maddow, in her narrative about this reported French hack, she used it essentially as evidence that all of the conspiracy theories that she has been pumping out for the last 6 months or more are fact. And of course, we still don't have public evidence to support most of the allegations of the Russian hack, alleged hack of the DNC, the Russian alleged hack of John Podesta, and the way that information was used. What we are seeing, and we'll get to the hearings on Capitol Hill in just a moment, is that there were connections between Trump and Russia. But I still have not seen any substantial evidence that the hacking was done by Russia, and this action in France included some of the same breadcrumbs or trails of evidence that were left by whoever hacked here in the United States. Allegedly Fancy Bear and Cozy Bear, right? Well, in France, we saw that IP addresses related to Russia. Some of the sloppy hacking work left evidence linked to Russia. But we also know from Vault 7, and most of us have known for years, that you can dummy up your IP address. You can do a lot to leave a trail to the other side. And the U.S. has and uses hacking tools that purport to be Russian. And so the bottom line is we really don't know. And one of the other similarities is that the Macron campaign immediately said, don't believe any of this stuff because some of it has been, doctored. Well, that's what we were told by the Clinton campaign, and WikiLeaks won that argument. Because whatever you think of Julian Assange and the role of WikiLeaks, the information that was released through them about the Clinton campaign has not been shown in any way to have been doctored. And the doctored claim has largely evaporated in the 56 to whatever hours it's been since this was first revealed on Friday. So I just still find myself in this untethered situation where the corporate media in this country has created a whole narrative about Trump and Russia. And there is damaging and circumstantial evidence of contacts between Trump and Russians that, deserve further scrutiny. But we still don't have the level of evidence that would satisfy me. Meanwhile, while we're talking about elections in South Korea, Moon Jae-in stands poised to succeed the ousted leader. He is running ahead in the vote count for new president of Korea, South Korea. And he's got an interesting resume. He is a human rights lawyer who became King's secretary to the last liberal leader of the country. And at that point, he tried to reconcile with North Korea. And my only discomfort is that his name is Moon. Because of Reverend Moon, the Unification Church, and the damage that they did in the United States and around the world. Also, a change of the guard in Gaza as the leadership of Hamas is being transferred to the former Gaza Prime Minister, Ismail Haniyeh, and it's described as a rebranding attempt. According to the Associated Press report, Hamas is trying to rebrand itself as an Islamic National Liberation Movement, as opposed to a branch of the Pan-Arab Muslim Brotherhood, which has been outlawed by Egypt. It has dropped its explicit language calling for Israel's destruction, though it retains the goal of eventually liberating all of historic Palestine, which includes much of what is now claimed by Israel. So it's hard to evaluate if these nuances will resonate with other parties, including the Netanyahu Zionist government. But it is an interesting change. Also, I want to credit Jonathan Ophir, the Israeli exile who lives in Scandinavia and who was a guest on our program a couple of months ago. He posted information today, including a video that was shot in the bathroom of the prison where Marwan Barghouti is being held. Now, Marwan Barghouti, I paused there because Omar Barghouti, who I believe is his brother, is a man who I have met. I don't know Marwan, but he is imprisoned in Israel, and he's leading the hunger strike, which is now 3 weeks on. And in order to undermine him, it appears that Israel has selectively edited video footage. And what's critical, as Jonathan Ophir points out, is that there are different segments to this video footage. And let's say there are five pieces, four of them have timestamps on them. And they show Barghouti entering a restroom, sitting on the toilet, and then they cut to the footage without the timestamp, where he is seen pulling out some sort of a cracker or wafer and eating it. Now, this, of course, would not play well with the other Palestinian prisoners who are observing the hunger strike. But at this point, the credibility of this video is in dispute. And, of course, I lean toward a propaganda piece as opposed to anything that's actually authentic. Now to the testimony on Capitol Hill today, as Sally Yates and the former Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, the proven perjurer, came up on the Hill to talk about the Trump-Russia investigation. And what's interesting is just ahead of that, two former unnamed Obama administration officials leaked to the New York Times that President Obama had warned Trump against hiring Mike Flynn to be part of his national security team when the two met on November 10th in the Oval Office last year. Obama reportedly told Trump that he would have profound concerns about Flynn becoming a top national security aide, and of course Trump ignored that advice, made him the top national security advisor, and 24 days in, he was fired because of his alleged inappropriate contacts with the Russian ambassador. But as we know, it goes deeper than that. Mike Flynn was accepting money, essentially a foreign lobbyist for Turkey, which he did not report. There was also the bizarre meeting reported by former CIA Director Jim Woolsey, where he left the room because Flynn was talking with other people, essentially about kidnapping Fethullah Gulen, the Turkish imam who is exiled in Pennsylvania, at the behest of the Erdogan government in Turkey. So there are many issues. Not all of them appear to be surfacing at this hearing today. But Sally Yates, the former acting attorney general during the interim period, testified that she told Trump's White House in its early days that Mike Flynn was susceptible to blackmail and that the White House didn't fire him until 2 weeks later. And Clapper confirmed that British intelligence officials shared very sensitive information about Russian connections to Trump's campaign. So I think these hearings will be considered, pretty dramatic. But once again, we have to ask, where is the evidence? Now, Sally Yates is not willing to talk about everything because some of it is controversial and some of it is confidential. It's top secret. But Trump was inappropriately tweeting about this and suggested, ask Sally Yates under oath if she knows how classified information got into the newspapers soon after she explained it to the White House counsel. So he's accusing her of being a leaker. And this, of course, really, as I said, is inappropriate for a president to get involved, particularly when he's the ultimate subject of this investigation. Now, one of the oddities that has surfaced so far, and I'm working off online news accounts, I haven't had a chance to watch any of the excerpts of the hearings yet, but according to the New York Times, James Clapper, when Trump had tweeted out that the Obama team had wiretapped him at Trump Tower, he gave this sweeping statement. There was no such wiretap activity mounted against the president-elect, or as a candidate, or against his campaign. But it turns out that the FBI had not briefed the Director of National Intelligence, and he sits atop a separate division of the government, on the wiretaps of Carter Page, and that those were approved by the FISA court on the second attempt. And so it is interesting how the stovepipes and the, you know, little cubby holes, the pigeonholes work in Washington. And so it just calls into question more the assertions of James Clapper, both in October and in January, about the Trump-Russia case. I want to thank John Zweibel in Hawaii for linking me to Matt Taibbi's Rolling Stone story, where he looked at the Hillary Clinton campaign and the new book called Shattered. And in it, in his analysis, Matt Taibbi says his big takeaway was that the campaign in its early days could not agree on the real reasons why Hillary Clinton was running. They really didn't have a clear focus on the issues and exactly, you know, what it was she was running to do. And I find that fascinating because it really did play out in the early missteps of the campaign, where she was basically just hiding out, afraid to go public because of questions about the email scandal, Also, her crowds were so much smaller than Bernie Sanders that she was afraid to be embarrassed when the TV cameras zoomed out from the podium. And so the Taibbi piece also explores her personal paranoia that following the 2008 campaign, she actually sat down and spent time reading the emails between her top staff people to see who she thought was a traitor. And as that played out in the 2016 campaign, she was described as so cautious and unwilling to really engage because she was always worried that her words were going to be leaked. So it's an interesting snapshot of the Clinton campaign. Another interesting snapshot comes from the number cruncher Nate Cohn at the New York Times. And he says there's reason to be skeptical of what Hillary and others are citing as the Comey effect. And I've done so too. I believe that the way James Comey, the FBI director, interjected himself first in July to say that they wouldn't be pursuing charges against Secretary Clinton for her email issues, then the reopening after the Anthony Weiner laptop surfaced, and then the final notification to Congress that the case was once again closed. But Nate Cohn shows that even before the Comey letter was sent to Congress on October 28th, that Hillary's numbers were crashing in a severe way. Clinton was ahead by 6 points in the national polls and held a similar margin in states worth 270 electoral votes. But his first indication was a Florida poll that the polling calls ended before, just before, James Comey letter, his letter surfaced. So what it shows, at least here, is that she was declining and on track to lose before James Comey's letter surfaced. Here's a quote. In retrospect, there is virtually no evidence to support the view that Mrs. Clinton really had a 6-point lead by October 28. Even if it was a very reasonable interpretation of the polls that had been released at that point. She didn't have a 6-point lead in any of the 16 national surveys that went into the field on or after October 23rd and were completed before the Comey letter, including her steadily shrinking lead in the ABC Washington Post tracking poll. So, take a look at that. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscription. People like Judy Holloway, Linda Gray, Steve Wozenski, and Benny Alto. They're all monthly subscribers. I'd like you to match them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. There's a menu button no matter what device you use. You click on that, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber. That takes you to the sign-up page. And any day now, I'm going to update the sign-up page with our latest bonus book, which is Thomas Frank's Listen Liberal. I might even get to that today. So here is the item that I mentioned at the top of the podcast, the real poison pill, the hidden stinking turd that is buried in the American Health Care Act, the Trump Care bill, that passed through the House narrowly last Thursday. And I thought it was in there because I believe it was in the version that failed 6 weeks before. But I did a Google search that took me to benefitnews.com, and it answered my question. The American Health Care Act eliminates the controversial requirement under the ACA that employers provide health insurance to employees. Are you ready for that? 49% of Americans get their health coverage through their employer. Now, it used to be fully paid for by the employer. Now, the employee carries an increasing burden of the load. But the group plans provide lower rates, better coverage, and this could be a real killer of the whole attempt to so-called reform healthcare in this country. Because if 49% of the people are affected, not just the 3% like me who are self-employed and are using the Obamacare exchange, when people find out that they no longer have a guarantee of access to health insurance through their employer, I hope there'll be a real, real outrage. And we'll be watching to see. Last night on 60 Minutes, there was an interesting story from Indianapolis, Indiana, where a Latino man who's been in the country for more than 20 years, married to a citizen, has been deported. And this is a man who had a special status under immigration where he was supposed to come in once a year to check in, to report to ICE that he hadn't committed a crime or changed his status or violated the law. And he's been doing that for several years, and this last time, they didn't let him leave. His wife was sitting in the parking lot outside the government building when an agent came out and said, "Your husband will not be returning. He is being deported." And what was fascinating is that the wife voted for Trump. The husband didn't have voting rights. He had residency rights. And, of course, she regrets it, as did a number of white Americans who were at the interview table for 60 Minutes. It was a fascinating look at people with buyer's remorse. Meanwhile, in Texas, Greg Abbott has signed into law a bill banning so-called sanctuary cities across the state. And, of course, he and Jeff Sessions and others just freely misinterpret the whole aim of sanctuary cities. It is to prevent lack of cooperation of people who are not documented in reporting crimes that occur on a local basis. And this is something, of course, I fully support. But the right wing spins this as a violation of the law that puts everybody at risk from alien criminals. It's bullshit. But that is the line of their thinking. That's what they pursue. And so Texas has outlawed it. The New York Times has an interesting story about Maryland today because the legislature there started to pass a sanctuary state law, and the biggest opposition came from legal immigrants. And this began in Howard County. The county has twice as many Democrats as Republicans, a highly educated population. 1 in 5 residents was born abroad. But the bill met stout opposition from some of those very same foreign-born residents. So you cannot underestimate the way certain people perceive this issue. And here in California, the legislature is on the verge of passing a sanctuary state law, and it'll be interesting to see if Governor Jerry Brown signs it. He has not taken a position, and his last statements on sanctuary laws were 7 years ago when he was the attorney general, and he said he did not support them. Meanwhile, a case that was sensationalized for the immigration debate by the Trump White House, including Sean Spicer, has taken a new twist. This is in suburban Washington, Rockville, Maryland, and in March, two young men, students there, were accused of raping a 14-year-old girl in a bathroom. Then the father of one of the males, they are 18-year-old Henry Sanchez Millian and 17-year-old Jose Montano. I believe it was Sanchez Millian whose father was deported. Now we learn that the girl enticed these boys to take her into the bathroom to have sex, and that she took videos of them engaged in sexual activities with her. So now the district attorney has announced that he will drop the rape charges against at least Sanchez Millian, but they're going to file a new child pornography charge against him because the girl sent him a copy of the video. Now, this, of course, deeply twists the intent of anti-child pornography laws. And if she was a willing participant and shared the videos, how can he be held guilty or held responsible for possession of child pornography? That's just bizarre. And it shows how the immigration issues color and twist cases of this nature. There's an interesting piece at The Intercept today that the ACLU has sued the Trump administration for access to files on the January raid in Yemen where an American SEAL died, and the goals were, Trump claimed that the mission was a great success when in fact it was a failure, and as many as 25 innocent people were killed, including 10 children. And once again, not to annoy you, but this article at The Intercept does not include a mention that one of those 25 people, one of those 10 children, was the 8-year-old daughter of Anwar al-Awlaki. She was not suspected of any connection to terrorism, just an innocent bystander killed by the American death machinery. And I hope the ACLU is successful and gives us an independent review of this operation. I also want to reference that over the weekend I found time to watch a really good documentary that is being distributed by the PBS stations. It's called National Bird, and I found a link so that you can watch the entire documentary online. It's included in the show file for today's podcast. And it shows us the lives of 3 or 4 people who worked in the military drone operations and the deep post-traumatic stress disorders that they are experiencing. And it features Jesselyn Radick, the attorney who's represented many important whistleblowers, and also our friend Norman Solomon, who is one of the founders of the group Expose Facts, where Radick now works as a lead attorney. If it's okay with you, we'll drop into Oklahoma for a couple of stories here. It, of course, is the state that spawned Scott Pruitt, who is now the head dismantler of the Environmental Protection Agency. And as part of his wrecking crew operations, on Friday he announced the dismissal of at least 5 members of a major scientific review board, and he's planning to replace them with representatives from the industries whose pollution the agency is supposed to regulate. Isn't that beautiful? Meanwhile, in Oklahoma, Governor Mary Fallon, who I believe was the person who appointed Scott Pruitt as the state's attorney general before Trump plucked him and brought him to Washington, she signed a bill last week that's rushing into immediate effect under an emergency designation that criminalizes protest, particularly if it is related to pipelines or oil installations. And this is a really pernicious law. It will an individual who is considered trespassing at an oil facility can face a felony and a minimum $10,000 fine for impeding or inhibiting operations of the facility. If a trespasser actually succeeds in tampering with the infrastructure, the fine goes up to a possible $100,000, and the prison sentence is extended to a possible 10 years. And the statute implicates any organization found to be a conspirator with the trespasser, and that would allow them to fine a group like that with 10 times of the amount imposed on the individual who is considered to trespass or commit some form of vandalism. Now, this is really a desperate and unconstitutional effort to silence people for their First Amendment right to protest. And it goes even deeper than that in the conspiracy language. There are now 19 states, that have either passed or are considering anti-protest bills at this time. Last night on HBO, John Oliver did a great job of explaining net neutrality and the efforts of the new FCC chair, Ajit Pai, to dismantle it. And he offered his viewers the opportunity to send a comment to the FCC on its website. And they provided a link that forwarded you to the FCC. And when I did that, it was clear that the FCC website had crashed. It's recovered. I saw it was back up today. But I do commend John Oliver for not only explaining the story, but offering this route to activism for many of his couch potato viewers. And finally today, I wanted to issue a warning. If you think that the Fox News Channel is a deadly, virulent media outlet, you got to be worried about Sinclair Broadcasting. This is a company based in Baltimore that already has an ugly track record as a hard right-wing media outlet. What's dangerous is that they operate at the local level, and they also cut all kinds of corners. They are the cheapest broadcaster I know of. For example, they have stations scattered around the country. Most of the weather forecasts come from their headquarters in Baltimore. So their weather people aren't even in the city where their forecasts are being broadcast. So today it was announced that in a nearly $4 billion deal, Sinclair is acquiring the television stations of the Chicago Tribune Company. And this is dangerous because Tribune has 42 stations, 14 of them are Fox affiliates, and they are in many of the important major markets across the country. They're kind of low profile. A lot of people don't know too much about the Tribune stations. They operate with various networks, and their news is not as tabloid or right-wing as Sinclair. I've been following the antics of Sinclair Broadcasting for many years, and I do think they pose an equal or more serious threat to our media landscape than even the Fox News Channel does. Thanks for joining me for my news and comment podcast, delivered free every day for you and available on YouTube. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until